Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Chelsea Poe. You're listening to Why Are People Into That with Tina Horn.
Welcome to the 35th episode of Why Are People Into That, the podcast that just wants to be useful. My guest for this episode is Princess Callie, a retired dominatrix and director of the very impressive online BDSM education resource, Kink Academy. Callie recently published Enough to Make You Blush, a guide to erotic humiliation. This subject is of particular interest to my predilections, and I learned quite a lot about objectification, financial domination, and service from talking to Princess Callie. Thank you to everyone who has come out to support my sexting book at recent events in New York City. It is always the best to hang out with my fans in Meet Space. If you are in Los Angeles on April 6th, I'm teaching a free digital dirty talk class at the Pleasure Chest. So I'll see you there. If you like this show and you want to support it, please consider pledging my Patreon. I'm posting a new original writing project there, The A to Z of Queer Sex. Read it for as little as $5 a month at patreon.com/TinaHorn. So, put on your tutu and start scrubbing behind the toilets as we explore why are people into humiliation. What's up? This is Callie.
Hey, years, and it's always a particular delight when a faved author enjoys your work. So yeah, thanks for having me on.
You had me on your site, which is Kink Academy, and I talked about Dirty Talk, and I think James Starling and I did a segment about trans male sex, and
yeah.
You've got years and years of archives of videos of kinky experts demonstrating and explaining how to do everything that there is to do, right?
It does cover a pretty wide range. We've right now we're at about 1,400 videos with about 130 different educators and therapists and doctors and sexperts and porn stars and, you know, people that just have a lot of variety of perspectives on kink and sexuality and gender and relationships. And it's intended as a way for people to learn on their own schedule and in the privacy of their own home.
Which can be really important for some people who can't be out.
Right. You know, I it launched about, maybe 8.5 years ago, nearly 9 years ago.
Wow.
And it came from the fact that, you know, I mean, I teach at a lot of kink events and used to travel quite a bit for it, and realizing how many people in the world aren't able to go to classes for whatever reason,
and
that those people deserve to learn from smart, kinky people, too.
Absolutely. Well, I love the site and I think it's a great resource and there's totally something on there for everyone. But then you have Passionate You, right?
Yeah. Passionate You is the sister site that's a bit more of a kind of vanilla bent for those that aren't looking to set their partners on fire, but would really love to learn some great blowjob techniques.
Right, like they want to set their partners on like a metaphysical fire, like figurative fire.
Exactly. exactly. And again, you know, the idea that anybody and everybody deserves to learn, you know, how to improve their sex life.
Awesome. And so you are now a retired dominatrix, is that right?
Yeah, I retired probably about 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, okay. It was kind of a soft retirement in that I didn't really make an announcement necessarily. But as my focus shifted more to Kink Academy, because it's a very small bootstrapping business,
so to speak,
the desire to focus on education was stronger. But I was a dominatrix for 10 years and loved it. Loved it.
Yeah, you and I are so similar in that regard, not only being dominatrixes for 10 years, but also, like, retiring not with this, like, oh, I had to get out of it, or, like, was so burnt out, which is, you know, for some people, that's what their story is, but that we both kind of were like, well, there's only so many hours in the day. Being a dominatrix is not just showing up and getting a foot massage, although it is also that.
That is.
But you're an entrepreneur when you're a sex worker, and it's time consuming. And if you have writing and education and other things to tend to, then there's only so much energy that you can put into it. Was that more or less? Sounds like that was your experience.
Yeah, I loved my work. Was a dom when I lived in Boston and had 6 dungeons over the course of the years and, you know, met and played with so many people and was, and I'm also still a lifestyle dominant. I mean, kink is a major part of my identity. And so I still have submissives and keep in touch with, you know, ex-clients and that sort of thing. But yeah, it felt like it had kind of run its course in that manifestation.
Totally. And so, you have a book out now.
Yes. Well, and that's where, you know, I am grateful to that portion of my career because it gave me lots of fodder, which now has filled up this book about humiliation. Humiliation was something pretty much right off the bat that I understood and enjoyed, and I started teaching classes on it pretty quickly, and it became probably the thing I'm most well known for is the humiliation bent in domination scenes, and so finally, after about 10 years of thinking about writing a book, I finally just decided to do it, and I'm really glad I did. I'm really proud of how it's turned out.
Yeah, well, I am very excited about it. I'm holding it in my hands right now. It's called Enough to Make You Blush, Exploring Erotic Humiliation by Princess Callie. And you self-published this?
I did. I'm lo and behold, a control freak. And decided that, you know, since I'd be doing all the marketing and all of that anyways, I decided to self-publish.
Awesome. Well, you did a great job. And, you know, this is another thing that you and I have in common, because though I have learned to tie many knots and have learned how to throw a single tail and various other things that are more based in the physical world, the abstract, conceptual, and psychological elements of kink were always my specialty, speciality, as a professional, and continue to be a source of fascination for me. And I think that seeing that you had written the book on humiliation was really exciting to me, because it's harder to teach about, and it's harder to talk about, because you have to create structure around something that in a way is formless and elusive.
Yes, and is different for every person.
Exactly.
You know, and like the term erotic humiliation is kind of a umbrella catch-all, you know, that
right.
What is humiliating to one person is not humiliating to another person, whereas the act of spanking, which of course might be experienced differently and might have different motivations, the spanking itself is pretty much the same thing no matter who you're playing with, whereas
right.
This sort of psychological exploration includes anything from, like, you know, nudity, objectification, chastity, sissification. You know, it's this huge, huge, huge umbrella. And so I think it's one of the reasons that it's my favorite topic, is because there is so much to play with.
So how would you define erotic humiliation for our listeners?
Sure. You know, first of all, I think that it's important to recognize that there's different levels of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I say humiliation, I'm specifically talking about the erotic experience, right? The experience of being chewed out by your boss in front of your peers isn't necessarily going to be the same sort of erotic trigger as perhaps your dominant partner making you wear your panties around your ankles and while they spank you and emphasize your exposure and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
So erotic humiliation is really about an emotional state. It's because the activities themselves are so they're so varied for everybody. What we're really talking about is that emotional state of arousal from being embarrassed. And I mean, it's complicated. It's a complicated concept because I think the English language does not really give us much nuance, you know, in ways of talking about this sort of thing. But it's that experience of being turned on, typically by being lessened in some way,
like
if that
diminished
makes sense.
Yeah, diminished or belittled,
right? And of course, like all kink, it's really important that there is consent and a level of affection, right? Like, we're not looking to
Absolutely.
Damage people doing this, and so that's why I think it gets so confusing for people. I've always found it interesting that hardcore kinksters who, you know, tie people to trees and, you know, whip them and, you know, blah, 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 are like, but how could you be mean
right.
like that?
Right, right. And, well, okay, so that's so funny. So erotic humiliation is about playing with people's emotions consensually, and humiliation is a strong reaction that is not easier to harness, but I don't know. I'm trying to think of like other emotions that you could play with that would be more elusive or maybe like not the right. Okay, why do you think the humiliation is erotic when other emotions are not necessarily erotic? Like, I guess I don't know that many people who find sorrow to be erotic. Am I wrong?
No, you're not. That's a really interesting question. You know, I know a lot of people who get turned on by tears, but not necessarily sadness.
Right.
Right?
I mean, you can cry from feeling humiliated.
Oh, and many do, yeah.
Or you can cry from an extreme physical sensation.
Right, 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 right. I mean, I think that taboo has a lot to do with it, you know? I mean, most societies do not encourage active humiliation of one another, right? Like, and I know that as a cisgendered female dominant, and a lot of the women that I've worked with on the dominant side of things particularly struggle with this idea of, you know, not rocking the boat, being nice to everybody,
right, that sort of thing. Right.
And so I think that, like many things in the kink world, the fact that we're not supposed to enjoy it is, in some ways, a reason for attraction.
Right, but then a lot of people do, a lot of people experiment with non-consensual humiliation. I mean, bullying, of course, is non-consensual humiliation. To say nothing of more grown-up kinds of emotional abuse, which may be a bit of a heavy topic, but I do think that it's important and that this is one of the right places for us to distinguish between being mean, being emotionally manipulative, enjoying the humiliation or degradation or belittling of your partner, and playing with that erotically. And sometimes the like intensity of, or the fear of that is part of what informs the eroticism, but it's just very important to put it in the context of consent.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that bullying is an issue from childhood all the way into adulthood. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
I think all of us know adult bullies, and that stuff has a lot more to do with grasping at power non-consensually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tend to think that those people need to explore BDSM to understand that there are ways to express, you know, a need to feel powerful or a need to feel superior to someone, but within the context of consent and of enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, the kind of bullying that takes place non-consensually is about grasping at that kind of power in a really abusive sort of way.
That's
why, you know, I understand the confusion that people have about erotic humiliation, you know, because superficially it can look this, it can look similarly, you know, there's some viral video going around about a woman who's being forced to walk naked by her husband, and they're speaking Spanish, and he's saying, you know, this is because you were texting photos.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, I have a Google alert for
and
sexting.
My first thought was, if this was consensual, holy fuck, how hot is that?
Right.
The fact that it was obviously not consensual, or at least it indicated that it was not consensual, is what makes it abusive, right? And so
I talk
a lot in my classes about how intention, not activity.
Interesting.
Is what's important. You know, I think people get very hung up on activity. You know, I flog, therefore I dom, sort of an attitude. You know, I crawl, therefore I submit.
Right.
And I think that that's baloney, really. I think that the intention behind this stuff is what is actually important. And within consensual erotic humiliation, the intent may short-term be to break somebody down or be broken down, but that the what makes it consensual, erotic, fun is that you move through that space, though, and back into a supportive, you know, positively intended experience.
Right. And I can say in my experience, I can say in my experience that being taken through the experience of being degraded by someone that I trust in a way that is hot and fun and consensual, and then surviving that, and then at the end of the person who's like calling me names or making me crawl around, that then that person picks me up and holds me and we go get ice cream. That makes me feel like when I walk down the street and somebody tries to humiliate me by catcalling me or whatever, that I just don't, it doesn't, like the spell is broken of that, because I've gone through it and come back the other side. It's like exercise. My like those muscles yeah. are those muscles are strong, and I know what to do with my yeah. emotional reaction to that.
I think that a lot of kink is about exploring the uncontrollable in a controlled way. You know,
And that's very well said.
Oh, thank you. That you know, the idea of being vulnerable and of feeling unsafe in a situation that is actually safe. You know, and that is the art of it. And that is why I think, you know, that humiliation play is not something to take on lightly. You know, I mean, I think that there's embarrassment is what I consider kind of low level, kind of more teasing. It tends to sound a bit more affectionate, sort of a thing. That's an easier thing to play with, but really when we're delving into hot buttons, and a lot of times the stuff that turns us on is the stuff that is the most taboo in our lives.
Right.
You know, that it's about exploring all of those things, but in a way that is, that you are aware of, and that you have on both sides of the power dynamic, a level of control.
So what are some examples of erotic humiliation? Give me some visuals, some concrete ideas.
Sure. So one of my favorite examples is satin panties on cisgendered straight men. Because it's such a perfect illustration of how a person's emotional response is what's important. Because if you know, traditionally, women's clothing on men, and I'm talking, of course, fairly cisgendered hetero sort of context here, but sure. tends to be, you know, emasculating. Like right. it's considered to be emasculating.
Right.
And so if you put a cis straight man in panties and he feels that it's emasculating, there's going to be this real kind of, you know, lowering of himself, right?
Right,
but
and
if you
you're
put those same panties, like one of my submissives, his name's Wimpy, he's kind of more genderqueer. When I put panties on him, he's prancing around, singing about how pretty he is and how satiny his ass feels, you know. And so here's something that the action itself could go either way,
right?
But if you take into context how somebody feels about it, and that's why understanding the broader world we live in and how it affects kink is really important. You know, I think, you know, misogyny is a major reason why the stuff that's considered humiliating is often considered humiliating.
Totally. And this particular hypothetical cis man who is put in satin panties by his dominant I liked what you said about how it is playing with that person's emotions, because it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what they literally think or believe, right? Like, that particular cis male individual could believe that all people of all genders are equal, that women are not inferior to men, that literally satin is just a fucking material, and any meaning or association that you may have with it is totally socialized or totally in your own head, and yet you have a very strong reaction, like, this is not okay, or this is not something that should happen, or the only reason I'm doing this is because this person is forcing me to, otherwise I wouldn't. And it's not like, oh, satin's like not really my material. It's like satin feels and looks and represents something that I've been taught to fear. And then when you think about it, it's like, wow, if you're so scared of being a woman, that really gives femininity quite a lot of power, doesn't it?
Well, and that's, and I want to state that people on the entire gender spectrum can enjoy humiliation, right? Like, this example is about cisgendered men, and I have another little example that I think also really illustrates it, that I had a submissive come to me one day, and he said, I was watching a video on YouTube where this man in India was slapped by a woman. And he said, you know, you could just see the shame on his face. And my submissive was like, it was so hot, you know, that he jerked off to it for like, you know, all night long. And so I finally said to him, I said, okay, well, I'd like you to take a look at the why you find this hot, right? So I want to dig a little deeper. I said, so he felt ashamed that a woman smacked him, right? He said, yeah. I said, do you think that he would have had the same response if a man smacked him? And he said, no. I said, okay, so why do you think he felt so ashamed, and which then was a turn on for you when being slapped by a woman? And he kind of sat there for a second, and finally I kind of see the light bulb go off, and he said, well, because he thinks that women are inferior, and so for a woman to slap him is humiliating because someone that is inferior to him is doing this. Right now this submissive would have classified himself as someone who respects women deeply.
Yeah.
But understanding the cultural implications that we are ingrained with.
Right.
And I mean, which is one of the reasons why slutty behavior is also a very popular humiliation activity for all gender.
Right.
Gender expressions. Because sex is something that we're ingrained to believe is a shameful thing to express.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And also that sluts have less power. You know, I mean, how does a slut have less power? Well, first of all, if you're wearing really high heels, it's harder to run away.
Right.
But also we have an archetype of the slut as a victim of violence, and also the slut as a just something that is worth less.
Yes. And so then I think that humiliation in a lot of ways is very much about the dichotomy of using these cultural implications, but recontextualizing them, right? And so that when I, for example, call somebody a slut in a session, right? And I'm kind of teasing them about how turned on they're getting, which of course then turns them on more because there's attention being drawn to it. I am making reference to that cultural definition of, oh my God, you're such a slut. I can't believe you're doing this. But what recontextualizes it is that there's also this element of, oh, and I love it. And I love that you're slutty. And so it's this real blending of an overarching cultural reference point, but then recontextualizing it usually into a celebratory way on some level.
So you use the word ashamed. So what is the relationship between shame and humiliation?
I think of shame as being a bit more negative, that shame is about you being a bad person. It tends to be more of a personal description rather than an activity, if that makes sense.
But sometimes the point of erotic humiliation is to play with somebody's reaction of feeling ashamed.
Right. And again, it's, you know, we want to come out on the other side positively, but oftentimes when you're mucking around in that experience, it is about playing with those triggers, and it's almost about setting off those bombs in our minds, but again, in an environment that is actually safe, even if superficially it's been painted to not be.
Yeah.
That's the difference, is that, okay, so I want to kind of shame you about the fact that you're getting turned on, for example, right? And so it's about really triggering that feeling, but then making sure that ultimately we come out on the other side.
So how do you do that? How do you come back out on the other side?
Well, and that's where consent is really important. You know, one of the questions I get most often is, can something be humiliating if you want it? Right? 'Cause, and this is a real concern for both dominants and submissives. It's like, and it keeps people from sharing their desires. And to my answer is a resounding yes. And in fact, the mere fact that you want it can be something that then is used for fodder.
Right, right.
For play. But making sure that there is, for me, I describe the five key differences. Consent, context, right? Again, it's this idea of being humiliated by your boss in front of your peers is not the same thing as being forced to march naked in a dungeon party, right?
Right, right.
So context can be important. Intention, okay? So is my intent to actually destroy you and then leave you there, or is my intent to play with these taboos and then move through them into aftercare or some sort of a affectionate-based relationship afterwards?
Or at least one of mutual respect. Like explicit
respect, trust is how I describe it, but I think that respect is another, you know, again, it superficially it doesn't look like I'm being very respectful if I'm pushing my partner's face into the toilet and giving them a flushy,
right?
But that they have to trust that my intention is
right. I see what you mean
Sometimes the respect is about respecting that even if it doesn't, quote unquote, make sense, that your partners are enjoying this and want it.
Yeah.
Because that's the other big obstacle that I find people have is just, you know, is when one partner says, particularly the partner that wants to be humiliated, says, I want this. And then the other person is very trepidatious because, you know, it's like, But are you gonna think that I'm a bad person?
Right,
you know, that
right.
sort of thing. And so you have to trust each other that you're both there and you're both communicating clearly, which is then the fifth key difference, which is communication.
You know, it's so funny, this idea of is it humiliating if I want it? Because if you think about something that one of the chapters in your book is about nudity, right? So the nudity of the exposure, the vulnerability, and also the taboo of nudity, like who is allowed to see you naked, who is supposed to be permitted to see you naked. So you can desire the excitement, the perhaps exhibitionist thrill of, you mentioned, walking naked through a dungeon. And you can desire that, but the reaction that you have when you see people looking at your naked body, if you're not used to that, or even if you are, that's like a physiological reaction of adrenaline or maybe arousal or self-consciousness, whatever it is, you know, stage fright, you know, there's a reason that so many people are, you know, have a phobia of public speaking, because the way that your body reacts, you can't control it. So if you deliberately put yourself in a situation where your body is influencing how you feel and are perceiving the world in a way that you can only control so much, that's exciting. I mean, it's the same as skydiving, right? Like,
oh yeah,
you can want to skydive. I don't particularly want to skydive myself, but or ride a roller coaster. You can want to do that, but part of the reason that you want to do it is that your body is going to react in a way that you lose control, which is probably another huge part of the appeal.
Right. Well, that's, you know, the physiological state of humiliation is very similar to the physiological state of arousal. Your heart beats fast, your palms maybe get sweaty, you feel really dizzy. In my book, I quote 60 other kinksters. I had put a survey online last year and got more than 300 responses, which was really amazing.
Awesome.
And in order to share the breadth of experience, I share a lot of the quotes from them. And a lot of them talk about these real physical responses and how those things get tied to being turned on.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when I'm thinking about it too, I'm thinking about the fact that I actually think that I really enjoy being humiliated. I really enjoy erotic humiliation. And it's hard to explain what you want. I guess you kind of have to find a container for it. You know, but even going back to to this example of walking naked through a dungeon, I am often naked in front of people. I think I have a much higher threshold for comfort with being naked in front of strangers or virtual strangers or friends who I'm not sexually or romantically involved in. And yet, if I were going to walk naked through a play party, I would also get a rush and a high from it just because it's a powerful thing to do.
And that's where, again, context.
Yeah.
Context makes such a big difference. And how someone's experiences these different things is what's so important. And it's why it's nearly impossible to just to try to engage in humiliation play without a pretty extensive discussion.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, like I have a similar experience and kind of relationship to nudity. Mm. I was a stripper for a couple of years before discovering professional domination, and I felt empowered.
Right.
I'd be the right. only naked. I did bachelor parties, and so I'd be the only naked girl in a room, and oftentimes the guys would try to, you know, humiliate me, and I would just kind of give them the stare back, because I was thinking, you know, I get to take my boobs and my ass and your money and leave. And so I don't really see what's so humiliating about this. But if you change that context, and if you make it about exposure, like for example, I find that instead of having someone be completely nude, it often feels more exposed when you do make them keep their underwear around their ankles, or when they just have a collar on, or when there's something either being covered or that's really emphasizing the aspects of exposure.
You know, it's so funny, when I was imagining myself just now walking naked through the party, I'm totally wearing like 6-inch stiletto heels. And
right?
I didn't even mention that. I was like, yeah, naked, like in my heels.
Right, but naked with something. And it's often that one piece of clothing, shoes or underwear or
even a necklace,
hat,
right?
You know,
yeah.
That is what changes that context from, oh, I'm just naked, to I'm being exposed, and there are all these emotional responses to that.
Mm. Okay, so let's talk about some more examples.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
One that I was really happy to see you tie into this discussion is financial domination, which is kind of having a moment, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a financial fetish activist for a really long time, because I think that it really gets a bad rap, you know, that, oh, it can be, you know, a real abuse of power and stuff. But it's like, I look at all the other kinky shit that we all do, and I think, you know, abusiveness is abusiveness, and money is a tool of power. And so why would you
I mean, it's just like everything, as if money and the exchange of money or the, like, theft of money is not explicitly abused every day in the way that, I could go on a rant, but I imagine everyone knows what I'm talking about when I say that money is abused in non-explicitly sexual contexts every day.
All the time.
Perhaps it's happened to you today.
Right. And so this is, again, about reclaiming the power of those things.
Right.
And playing with it at a level that is appropriate. Lots of financial fetishists fantasize about bankruptcy play and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But that's unsafe levels in the same way that somebody who's doing single tail whipping can do it in a safe way or in an unsafe way.
So can you define financial domination for our listeners?
Sure. Financial domination really at its heart is simply using money as a tool of power. And so when it comes to humiliation play, because not all financial play is about humiliation, but for those that do like to play with that particular dynamic, it's about using money to either exert control or to take away someone's control or power, right?
Right.
And so the idea that it can be something as simple as I command my submissive to buy me a Starbucks coffee every day that they come to see me, or it could be something as extravagant as, instructing them to buy me a pair of Christian Louboutin shoes that are really expensive and are going to look amazing on my feet.
Yeah.
as an example. It's about using money as a tool the same way you would a paddle or a dog collar or whatever.
Right. Well, the shoe one is interesting because then there's this also, I think that's not as the shopping, I think, is not as difficult for people to wrap their minds around, because it's like, okay, I either have a shoe fetish or a foot fetish, or I appreciate fine luxury items and appreciate, showing off my taste, and I appreciate, like, giving gifts. Okay, like, I feel like most people can wrap their minds around that. They see you in a photo shoot in the shoes that they bought you and they feel close to you. But then there's also financial domination that just has to do with give me cash. Give me cash now.
Yeah.
For no reason, just because I said so. And people go nuts for it.
In all directions, definitely. I mean, and that's why, FinDom is kind of the shortening term that a lot of women online use.
Yeah.
And there are lots of people in the world. They tend to be men, but it's not only men that enjoy. I had a female submissive that enjoyed sending me gifts and money and that sort of thing. That truly just enjoy that experience of having cash demanded from them.
Yeah.
And again, it's because money is a symbol of power.
Right.
We are culturally ingrained with the idea that the person with the money is the power. So if I take your money, that is that's a pretty symbolic and yet practical way to implement that feeling.
And also, if you turn to me and give me enough attention to say, give me your money, then in whatever way you need me, because you need that money or you want that money. And I'm the ATM. I'm the ATM, so I'm useful.
Class just on the topic, because it's
sure.
There can be so much nuance in the way that you approach it and that sort of thing, because I think that it is a myth that you can just, as a dominant, hold your hand out and someone will just give you money and that they don't get anything in return. If they're not experiencing their goal feeling, then it's probably not going to happen again or very often. You know what I mean? It may not be a symbiotic relationship that everyone can relate to, but that there has to be some kind of a symbiotic experience there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's talk about service, like domestic service or being in service to someone, and how that can play with humiliation.
Sure. And this is where, again, the kind of cultural reference point of classism mm-hmm. has a lot to do with it. You know, that the idea, particularly, I think, you know, in America and Western countries, you know, domestic chores are considered, you know, kind of beneath, you know, like people consider them beneath them, you know,
right.
like the idea that you would, you know, that it's kind of degrading to have to be a house cleaner or something. And I mean, and I know lots of people who are house cleaners who are amazing people who don't see it that way at all. But if you take that sort of cultural reference point,
right,
and you play with it within this sort of erotic context, then the mere act of doing my dishes becomes a erotically charged, humiliating experience.
Yeah, I think the thing that is coming up a lot in this particular subject that I'm always trying to emphasize is that you don't have to believe in
right.
these cultural ideas in order to play with them erotically.
And to be affected by them.
That's right. I mean, that's right. So you don't have to believe, it goes back to the panties thing, right?
Right.
You don't have to believe that women are inferior and that wearing a skirt makes you inferior or subjugated in order to be affected by it or in order to play with it. You don't have to believe that doing the dishes is a degrading act only suited for certain types of people, which of course is wrapped up in sexism and racism and classism
yeah.
and
yeah.
lots of other things, and nationalism. And you don't have to believe that in order to, yeah, as you say, to be affected by it and to choose to play with it erotically. But and the way that you differentiate, the way that you know the difference is your five tools. Let's see if I can remember them. They're consent, context, trust, intention, and what?
And communication.
And communication.
Yeah. Tina, gold star.
I mean, what do I get? What do I get, princess?
Oh, something fun. Panties on your head.
Panties on my head. Okay, doing it. I have panties on my head now.
Nice. Good job.
Radio.
Good job. Yeah, and that's the thing is, I mean, you know, people I think often forget that our intellect is often separated from our arousal. You
the
know?
Devil, you say.
What?
The devil, you say. What?
Right? It, you know, that it's like, the idea that someone, you know, like a woman might identify strongly as a feminist, as an empowered woman.
Fuck yeah.
You know, and then want to be tied up and gang raped.
Yeah, come on, man.
Consensually.
Yeah.
Right? And that desire can seem confusing until you understand that often the things that are the most taboo are the most powerfully attractive.
Yeah, well, I agree.
And so that's what all of this is about mucking around in these sorts of psychological playgrounds that we've been, most of us have spent our lives being told we're not supposed to, and yet here we are able to do them in ways that are fun and arousing and connecting. You know, it's an incredibly intimate experience to humiliate and be humiliated.
Yeah, you feel like you really get inside someone's head or let
yeah,
someone inside yours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I think that, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had there, obviously, but that it's really helpful to take these kind of larger psychological considerations, you know, and consciously apply them as opposed
yeah.
to just kind of, you know, having them affect you, but not really playing with them the way that you can.
So let's talk a little bit more about service. What are some other great ways that you can play with service, or that you can play with the humiliating aspect of being in service to someone?
Sure, I love doing it. I mean, the white glove test is kind of a pretty fun thing to play with. You know, if you instruct somebody to clean your house, and I like to leave little notes in hard to find places, like say behind the toilet or whatever, because then it's a fun thing for them to find when they're playing, and maybe it's got a little extra instruction, like, you know, kiss my toilet seat or something. Or if they don't find it, then it's something that can be used as fodder for, you know, punishment for not being thorough enough, that sort of thing. You know, service can be anything from pouring coffee in the exact perfect way. Mm. Sarah Sloan, who's a great kink educator, has an awesome tip for coffee drinkers, that if you go to the paint store and find a paint swatch with the color that you like the coffee,
right,
that it can be, you know, that act of preparing your favorite food or your cup of coffee in a perfect way can be something that is an act of service that can have this element of humiliation because you are being set up as a servant.
And what's in it for the person who's scrubbing behind the toilet or studying the perfect cup of coffee or maybe even being your human furniture or your human ashtray? I mean, I have some ideas, but I'd love to hear your perspective on what's in it for the person who's being humiliated and also doing all of these, you know, tasks that maybe we don't see the fun in them.
You know, one thing that has come up a lot, and I've had quite a few service submissives myself, as well as I teach classes specifically about service training. Mm. And I think that being of use
is
one of the most popular reasons for it, is that it's a very practical thing, you know? And like, I had one service submissive who talked about how much he loved looking at a clean room after he'd cleaned, that there was a start point and there was an end point, and he could feel successful because he could look at the room and see the job he had done and know that was a concretely helpful thing for me in my life.
Also, there are things that need to get done, and if you turn them into a sex game, then they're fun.
Right. I'm an efficiency slut. If I can get something done in my life while also being kinky and getting turned on, I consider that a win.
Same. It's multitasking. It's for the
multitasking
kinkster. Yes. And also in terms of efficiency, if you, like, let's say you only have so much time in the evening and you want to fuck and the house needs to get tidied, right? So the foreplay, if you make the foreplay into
the cleaning,
then that's also very time efficient.
That is a win-win-win.
And there's probably, depending on somebody's style, like an individual's style or a couple's style and what works for them, or of course group's style as well, there could be different levels. Like, there are probably some people who find it the most satisfying and the most that pushes their humiliation buttons the most if they are totally ignored. Like, Stephen Elliott was on the show and talked about how hot it is for him to be just completely ignored in any way. And so, you know, I can imagine on one hand, you know, you instruct your submissive to make the bathroom shiny and spotless, and then you leave and go out to dinner or go out with your girlfriends, go shopping or go to the gym or whatever, and you come back and it's totally done, and then they get some sort of reward or regard or whatever. But then also you could be like on the couch in lingerie the entire time, reading a book with your legs spread, reminding them not to get distracted while they're cleaning.
Exactly.
And that adds another sort of level of sort of sexual withholding to the humiliation. No? Yes?
Yes, absolutely. That again, where you take this single activity, domestic service,
right?
And there's a wide range of dynamics and styles that you can use to play with that. You know, I love the whole laying on the couch. You know, you're going to clean so that I don't have to, and I get, you know, a break and don't look up my skirt while you're doing that sort of a thing. I think that that then becomes a very sexually charged like an obviously sexually charged experience,
right.
but that level of ignoring also is incredibly powerful. You know,
yeah.
I think that a lot of this stuff is also about social release in a lot of ways.
Hmm.
You know, is that we again come from this greater cultural experience of, you know, we're supposed to want to be the center of attention. You know, we're supposed to want the people that we lust after to lust back. And so it becomes this really powerful thing to turn that stuff on its head.
Yeah. And I'm also imagining like a group scenario in which someone feels socially awkward, but if they're given a task to do and they know that they're doing that to please their partner, to please their dominant, then they can really focus on that and feel totally at ease. And it doesn't have to be like they're wearing like a sissy maid's outfit and like dusting all around while the ladies like have martinis, although that sounds like a great scene too. But it could be something much more subtle, like you're going to be in charge of the grill tonight at this party. And you're not going to move from behind the grill, and you're going to make everybody their burgers exactly the way that they want them, and you're going to keep the veggie burgers on a different part of the grill, and that is what you're going to do at this party, and I'm going to check in on you every so often and maybe give you bathroom breaks, but other than that, you're behind the grill. And then that person doesn't have to worry or have anxiety about
all of the other things, most definitely. One of the things I say often about particularly like objectification is that, you know, being an adult is kind of hard and it's complicated and you're,
it requires tons of subjectification.
Right. Well, and that, you know, that there's all of these adulting things that most of us have to juggle.
Yeah.
But when I turn somebody into a lamp,
right,
all they have to think about is being a lamp.
Oh my
That's
God.
It.
There's such a cute little lamp person on the cover of your book.
That's one of my favorite photos of all time, because that was a submissive I had that was very cerebral, had a very hard time shutting his head off, you know, felt like he was supposed to be juggling the whole world. And so when I stripped that identity away from him and said, no, your only job is to be a lamp, is to hold this light bulb cord in a way that I can sit here and read my magazine, he was forced, again, in a consensual environment, to focus on a single thing. And it is an incredible psychological relief to not have to be juggling all of that stuff.
Can I tell you about another thing that is very sexually charged for me, but that often happens in a non-explicitly sexual context?
Yeah.
I find it, and that I've realized over time, has to do with like a little spice of humiliation. I have always been so excited by other girls doing my hair and makeup, and it brings out, because I always feel so hopeless and like I always know that if somebody's doing my makeup that they are better at it than me, because pretty much everybody else in the world is better at makeup than me. So if I like give myself over to, in a way, I've spoken about this before in the context of like being sort of like playfully forced feminized, even though I am a cis woman, as if gender and separate from anyway. what do you know? But there is also an element of it makes me feel like a little boy who is getting force feminized in that moment, and that doesn't mean that I believe that little boys can't wear makeup in any way, or that grown men can't wear makeup, but that's, I was raised with that very strong association. And so I feel like the center of attention, but I also feel like the reason I'm the center of attention is that I'm not good at it and I can't do it myself. But it feels so satisfying to admit, I can't do it. Will you please do it for me? Whereas, and that feels like good humiliation, but like if somebody said, like, do your hair and makeup right now in front of this group of people, and then we're going to scrutinize the work that you've done, that would make me feel, I think, bad humiliation, like not sexy humiliation.
Yeah.
Unless I was given the right context. But yeah. And it gives me like tingles down the back of my neck. And when I was really little, I remember getting like tingles down the back of my neck if somebody like put makeup on me.
Because there is a level of objectification, right? Like you're a little adult. You know, and that, again, objectification is this really powerful thing because we're all expected to be these multifaceted people all the time.
Right.
It's exhausting.
Right.
And so when you get stripped of that and instead are objectified in this way of like, sit down, you know, so that I'm just going to do this to you.
And I also get to be the focus of their attention in a way that's completely like, that's completely okay. And I don't have to feel self-conscious about staring at them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just felt like sharing that, I guess.
No, thank you. Cause I think that that's awesome. And again, it speaks to how context matters because if you were being judged on your makeup applying skills, suddenly that's not really so fun because the intention is to tear you down instead of building you up.
Oh, actually, I have another story to tell you. Can I tell you another story? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And then maybe you can tell us a story?
Yeah.
Okay. I was in a session once and with a client, and the client wanted to be dominant and he wanted to do a personal trainer role play. Have you ever done one of those?
Yep.
So I was like, sure, great, fun. I like to work out. That sounds great. And so he was instructing me to do jumping jacks and, you know, I'm like flopping around naked doing jumping jacks.
Yep.
And then he, you know, instructed me to do this and do that and was sort of like critiquing my form. Okay. And then this had been going on for a little while and it was feeling totally fine and totally fun and totally like a great day at work. And then all of a sudden he starts saying, you're so fat. No one is ever going to want to date you if you don't work harder at working out. You are, nobody likes a fat person, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I burst into tears. And it is the only time that I have ever cried like that during a session. Like, maybe I've cried like a little bit from being pushed with physical pain, but in a way that I was okay crying.
Yep.
But I don't know if I've ever like lost control in that sort of involuntary physical reaction of like losing my professional. I've never like burst out laughing at someone when I didn't mean to in session. And he was, so here's the thing about the story. I started crying. He looked horrified. And I said, no. I was able to gather myself. I was like, no. It's totally fine. Like, I'm going to I used my safe word. I was like, we need to calm down. And he felt so bad. And the thing about it was that I don't really think that it was that outrageous or of a thing for him to say. I think that, you know, within the context of the role play that we had negotiated and agreed to, it made sense to push that element of the humiliation. But I was raised as a woman in American society, and the idea that if I'm fat, no one will ever love me is just, I'm socialized to think that that's like the worst thing that could ever happen. Even though I am not super skinny and I never have been, and I don't believe, going back to what we were saying before, I don't believe that.
Like,
I have loved many people who identify as fat. I see many people who identify as fat loving and being loved around me all the time, as if I actually needed that proof to believe that it was true. Like, I don't believe that, and yet it was such a deep reaction that it pushed me into a level of humiliation that I, where I didn't want to go. And it was fine. And we like finished the scene and like talked about it. And like that was completely resolved. But it taught me that calling me fat and ugly is one of my only, frankly, hard limits. And here's the coda. Here's the last thing that I'll say. When I tell people that that is one of my limits, they almost always say, why would anybody say that to you? Why would anybody call you ugly? You're so pretty. But that's not the fucking point of BDSM.
Right.
Like, oh, and stupid. That's the other one that is a hard limit. In case anybody's taking notes. Stupid, stupid, fat, ugly, you know? And also, I would not judge somebody who wanted to play with being called any of those things. But for me, I know that they are my hard limits. So that's my story.
Yeah, well, and that, you know, body shaming and intellect shaming tend to be the two least popular, most triggering things. Even people who like very hardcore degradation in other ways,
which I do, by the way,
right? But comments about weight or body or intellect tend to be triggering. I mean,
so
there are some people who enjoyed it. Like, I'm going to be posting some of my statistics from my survey on my site, enoughtomakeyoublush.com, soon, because it was interesting to see that there were some people who enjoyed it, but it was such a tiny fraction. And again, I think that it's because of these cultural messages that are drilled into us, so that they go beyond what we intellectually believe into just these deep, deep things that we are taught in the world. And that's why they tend to be so triggering. I can match you with on the other side of a story similar to that.
Awesome.
That I tell in the book about a guy who had been emailing me for weeks about wanting to come in to do small dick humiliation, which is
pretty very popular.
Yep. Definitely one of the more popular online fetishes.
Yeah.
And so he wrote me these lengthy emails about all these fantasies he's had for years and years and years about going into bars and a woman making fun of his small penis, or getting ready to make love to a woman and then she bursts out laughing. So he comes in for his first session ever. He had never done an actual session and he just always fantasized about it. And he comes in and I am very verbal and I just immediately start laying into him, because I had read all of his emails. I knew exactly what he was coming in for.
Yeah.
So I start laying into him. You tiny golf pencil dick nub of a, you know, your manhood. There's no manhood there. And within minutes, he was sobbing on the floor, and not in like a cathartic release sobbing, but in like a utter horror realization that he has a small penis. And I was horrified. I mean, I'd like to say that your session guy's response is appropriate. You should be horrified, right?
Yeah.
Because there is a difference between the consensual desirable experience and a trigger being tripped.
But sometimes don't know until you try. And that's why you need to go into kink. You need to be brave, and you need to understand that things are not, that reality hurts more and smells weirder than fantasy, right?
Yeah.
And that also that you have some kind of safety net or trail of breadcrumbs out of it if you encounter something that you didn't expect, because that's part of what you're trying to get at, right? Is some genuine danger, whether it's physical or psychological danger.
Right. The risk is part of the attraction. But
right.
Something I say all the time is that it's not if a trigger will get hit, it's when.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, the kink community talks a lot about aftercare.
Yeah.
But I consider aftercare is what happens when things go right. And so I always suggest people that before you delve into particularly these psychological things, that you have a trigger plan. And so not only do you share with your partner what you need when the scene goes as planned, but what you might need, right? And again, you know, best laid Plans of Mice and Men and all of that, you may think, you know, oh, if a trigger gets hit, I'm going to need to immediately go into a room and sit by myself in the dark. Well, then maybe the trigger gets tripped and all you want to do is get hugged and be told that you are a wonderful person. And so while it's important to, I think, plan ahead for when something like that might go wrong, it's also important to understand that there's a lot of factors that go into it. You might feel fine about a humiliating activity on Monday, but then Wednesday comes and your hormones are different, or something happened at work, or you had a bad dream the night before, and your experience and response to it might be something completely different.
Well, those are wise words, and as much as I feel like we could keep swapping stories for another hour, I have really enjoyed this conversation, and I am really enjoyed your book. I devoured it, and I highly recommend that people check it out. So it's called Enough to Make You Blush, Exploring Erotic Humiliation. And where, Princess Kelly, the self-publisher, can people get a copy of your book?
You can order it on Amazon. It's a Kindle and paperback.
Great.
My website, enoughtomakeyoublush.com. I also sell autographed copies. And I also, they didn't get finished until after I had sent you your copy, but I recently redesigned what I call scene starters, a deck of more than 200 filthy phrases for you to call your loved ones. And so if you go to my site, you can also see that, because verbal is something that can be a really big struggle. You know, we're not really taught to say these kind of naughty, filthy things.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we can get stuck. You know, you slut, you slutty slut, you know? And so, it's kind of like a kinky thesaurus in your pocket.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I love that in the back of your book. And I feel like if any of my listeners have already read my sexting book or are hoping to get their hands on a copy, or have taken any of my dirty talk classes, I hope, with your permission, Callie, with your permission, Your Highness, Princess, that I could even, how could somebody get a copy of these, starter kits? 'Cause I feel like that's something that I should really give out to people in my classes.
Yeah, they're for sale on my website, so you can order them direct from me.
And what is your URL again?
URL is enoughtomakeyoublush.com.
Awesome. And do you have other websites, or is that your main home on the interwebs now?
I basically live online, so I also do personal coaching, and
awesome.
That site is coachingbycallie.com.
Cool.
And then, as you mentioned, of course, kinkacademy.com, where I am one of the educators on the site, along with the other 129-ish educators, and Passionate You. And so those are the main sites.
Fantastic. And are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. Princess_Kali with a K, K-A-L-I.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for talking to me, and we'll talk dirty again real soon.
Ooh, sounds great. Thanks for having me on, Tina. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to episode 35. Follow at Tina Horns S on Twitter. Subscribe and write us a review on Acast, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And visit wirepeopleintothat.com to subscribe to our newsletter and listen to the archives of seasons 1 and 2. As ever, Wire People Into That is produced and hosted by yours truly, Tina Horn. Our theme song is by Pine from Oakland, California. Our website was designed by Justin Levesque, and this project is now supported by my generous and truly, truly outrageous patrons. Join the party at patreon.com/TinaHorn. Until next time, I'll be blushing everywhere.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.